Morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig and the Rapido. What's up for today? We're still back in Melbourne, Australia.
We sure are.
People.
And the interesting dilemma for the producers of this program with all the material that we have is how to divide it up into manageable segments that we can bring to you with something like a theme behind them. So anyway, this particular program focuses on Melbourne, Australia as a part of Southeast Asia. Not an association that most people would make, but it turns out there's a lot of excitement going on with cuisine from exotic countries there, and we assemble three different ones for you for today's program. First of all, a fascinating...
But they're not in Melbourne, make that clear.
Well, in two cases they are.
Oh, right.
Our first chef, in fact, is most famous for being an Australian with a Thai restaurant in Thailand, but he's opening a series of Thai restaurants in Melbourne as well. Then behind that, we have a person who's actually cooking according to his native heritage, Victor Leong, but Victor is Malay Chinese and is serving up some very innovative Chinese food in the city of Melbourne. And then finally, a totally fascinating fellow who decided that his life should be spent cooking Indian food, but in Bangkok, Thailand.
Yeah.
So if that doesn't sound like it's enough for you, then tune in again next week as well, because we'll be have more culinary superstars for you. But that's the content of today's program. There used to be a thing called story time. I'm not sure there is a thing called story time anymore in schools, because I haven't been in one for a very long time. But the first part of story time was, are we all sitting comfortably? David Thompson, from restaurants Thai all over the world, are you sitting comfortably?
I am indeed, teacher.
I have no idea where this man's going to go, listeners. You have to understand. He's an interesting character and a bit of a rogue, even though he says he's going to conceal that from you. But seriously, David, we've wanted to meet you since we walked past Dali Street Thai once more than 20 years ago.
Is it really more than 20 years?
And it was closed. You had another restaurant called Sailor Thai that I think had just opened, but the original one was close to a restaurant we had gone to for lunch. We walked by. We said we'd read about this crazy Australian who was cooking Thai food. We thought, well, we better check this out. You know, listeners, of course, that On the Menu Radio is interested in all those kinds of obscure things. How did all that begin, David? Did you begin doing something else with food, or did you always love Thai?
My whole relationship with food only began when I was about 22. I had a classic Australian background, in that it was Anglo-Celtic, and the food that my mother cooked was abominable. And it was compounded with the fact that I have to say, it was a universally acknowledged fact that my mother was the world's worst cook. So I suffered her bad cooking and her bad food, and her kindness in many other ways, but I suffered her food for many years, so I had no background in food whatsoever, no schooling in food, and no great appreciation of food. But then, when I was 22, I was just finishing a degree in English literature, a genetic time bomb went off. Clearly, the genes for that interest in food and cooking passed my mother's generation or came from my father's side. But I was 22 and all of a sudden I became obsessed with food. I read ravenously. I ate voraciously. All any other interest was cast aside as I became obsessed, preoccupied with food and cooking. And I was hopeless in my initial first clumsy attempts at cooking. But I was compelled to do so. It's something that was unconscious, or rather, it's something that was unconscious. No, it wasn't unconscious. It was something that was just driven from my belly, from my very being, that I just had to begin to cook.
Now, were you doing this just for yourself, or did the professional thing start, or did the professional thing come later?
Doing it for myself, I could not have unleashed that which I cooked onto the general public, I think I would have been arrested, and rightly so. No, I cooked for my poor parents, cooked for friends who were polite, or mostly polite anyway, and then I started to cook professionally, ages ago. It would have been 1982, 83, 84, I think. And I was not a good apprentice. I was very bad. I was lax, ill-disciplined, had no sense of style or taste. But with those nascent, incompetent steps, I started to then learn and grow and started to cook with more confidence and with a certain understanding. It was aided by the fact that I had a mind. Not a common thing in a cook in those days, which made me read and read about history and read about technique and read about different food from different cultures that helped to hasten my understanding of food and brought me up to scratch to being able to cook reasonably well.
Were there some singular events or some singular people who you think made a big difference along the way?
You mean before I started cooking Thai food?
While you were doing that.
Not really. I mean, there were a few good cooks that I liked, but it was more just reading about food and going back into the old, because old French masters. I also had how may I say it? My mind tends towards history as well as literature, and so I explored the past, and it does seem to be a consistent aspect of the way that I understand things is to understand the past first. And so I'd go back to Ténavant, to Escoffier, to Ferdinand Pointe, and then further back, of course, to Edouard Vigon, to the earlier cooks, Carême, and so on and so forth, chasing the French canon, because at that time, La Belle Cuisine was uber alles when it came to cooking. And so I went through there. I read those old recipes religiously, trying to translate them and trying to extract their very marrow from the words that were written, to suck those recipes dry in order to absorb as much knowledge as I could. And was I a good cook then? I don't think I was. Looking back, I don't think I was. I really didn't fall into a stylish pace until 4 or 5 years into cooking, but then I doubt any good cook can. Professionally, at least, anyway.
Okay, so where was your first professional experience? It was in Australia, but what kinds of places?
It was in Sydney. I'm a Sydney boy. And it was in a place called La Goulue, which was in Crow's Nest. Then I worked at, another French place down in East Sydney, Bagatelle, which had was of some renown in those dark, distant days. And then I worked at, Pavilion on the Park. And then I worked at a place called Butler's. And there I met a man called Mohinsberg Esmondson, who had lived in Thailand. And it was my first taste of Thai food. And indeed, around that time, I started to eat out quite frequently. And I had my first taste of Thai food. I still remember the dishes I had. I have not a bad taste memory. And I remember eating in a restaurant called the Siam, what they all called Siam after all, the Siam in Kalua Street in Bondi, and I remember having these rubbery fish cakes that were just awful. And it seems to be some consistency there. Still, I remember having lemongrass, which I hated. I remember being jolted by shrimp paste and shocked by chilies. I didn't like it at all. At all. But then I went to Thailand. My life is full of accidents and full of serendipity, really. I went to Thailand by mistake, and when I say by mistake, it's not that I got necessarily onto the wrong plane, but I was intending to go to another country. The people with whom I was traveling, with whom I was going to stay, rather, were going away. So we had some Thai kitchen hands at work who just said, go to Thailand. And because I had time on my hands and wanted to take time off, I went to Thailand, and I was won over from the very start. That's not entirely true. I was won over by the time, within a week or two. Sometimes you lob into the country and you feel at home, at ease, and that's exactly how I felt in Thailand, although it wasn't entirely at ease. There was a lot of incomprehension, because the way that Thais live, particularly back then, we're talking some 30 years ago almost now, was there a languid approach to life, an agreeable approach to life where their values and what their priorities was not about work, but about enjoyment. And I found that thrilling. I found that a revelation. I found that exciting. I found it liberating. I found it so different to the rather bourgeois, hard-working world from which I came, to that tropical, sweet, dulcet approach to living. And I was beguiled. Beguiled and enthralled. And I wanted to move there. So I decided to move there. I broke a relationship. I stayed. I was going there on holidays for 4 weeks and stayed for 8 weeks, which meant I really did get into trouble when I got back. But I didn't give a damn. I was seduced. I was won over.
Now, it's curious. A good friend of ours in Pittsburgh, a chef with a small chain of restaurants in Pittsburgh, and he went to Thailand because his girlfriend had a socioeconomic project in Thailand. So he went and spent a few months there, and then he came back, and he cooked what he could remember. He didn't really cook in Thailand, but he remembered the spices that were in the food, and he would reflect those in dishes that he created for us, which was so much fun. And we would say, "Bill, cook something for us." I mean, did that kind of thing happen, or were you more disciplined than that?
Didn't like Thai food when I first went over there. Didn't like it at all. It was strange. It was foreign. It was not. I didn't think it had any of the hallmarks of a great cuisine. I didn't. You know, it was interesting. It was novel. It was okay. It was a Sunday night takeaway type of food, really. I didn't place that much value on it. I liked Thailand because of the people, the boys in particular, and the culture and that laissez-faire, easy-going approach to living that was just so fascinating and beguiling, as I said. It wasn't the food. What happened, though, was bit by bit by bit, I became more aware of how important food was in Thai culture, and then I had the good fortune to meet this old woman who introduced me to Thai food as Thais understand it. And that was then the beginning of my affair with Thai food, because it's when you eat food that's cooked by somebody who has that inherent skill, that touch, that deft touch, where they can season a dish so well that makes the taste so sensible and as if it's just correct. And I think, Peter, you might know, and I think the listeners too might understand. Do you know when you eat something and you nod your head in appreciation? And it's one thing that happens throughout the world, I've noticed, is that when somebody likes the food that they're eating, they taste it and they just nod their head. Just a little nod saying, "Yep, that's not bad." That's what I found when I went to her place. It all started to make sense, or rather, it was the beginning of making sense. I still remember the first dish that she had, Peter, and it was that something called Geng Som Pla Chon Tot Bai Ma Kham, which in English means a deep-fried fish in a sour orange curry with tamarind leaves. I can see it in my mind's eye now. I can taste it as well. And it was the first inkling I got that there was more to Thai food than the little takeaway food that I had in Siam in Kalua Street some 10 years before. And the misconception that I had that Thai food was just merely a takeaway type of cuisine with nothing more to offer than a bit of sweet chili sauce and a toss of coriander. In through her hands, through her eyes, and due to her craft, it introduced me to an ancient way of cooking, a cooking that is as valuable as the Bel cuisine that held me in its thrall previously.
Okay, so then at some point it became a business. Called Dali Street Thai. That's a step in and of itself, a pretty significant step. How did that happen?
My business partners would say I'd never run a business. I'm just merely a cook. But look, if you are a cook and you fall in love with something, don't you want to do it professionally? I have the good fortune, Peter, to still love what I do, and that is to cook. I have a timeless pleasure. When I cooked earlier today during a cooking class for the Melbourne Food Festival, and I'll cook tonight. It's mostly not a chore. I loathe doing mise en place, which is a preparation. I'm too old for that. But I still have that innocent, timeless pleasure where cooking means I lose myself, and I use my craft, the craft that I love, that I love to do, and let me rephrase that. It is a timeless pleasure. And each and every time I do it, there is an innocent and wholesome joy and a fulfillment that gives me the greatest pleasure. And that is indeed the impetus that maintains any craftsman in their craft. And I'm very lucky in that, even at this older age, now 30 years into my career, I still have that same zest and delight that I had when I was an innocent cook, escaping from the claws of my mother's cooking.
So now we're dining with you tomorrow night. Are you going to be on the line tomorrow night, we hope?
With a tear in my eye, I'll be stir-frying some noodles for you.
Seriously, we're here for the Melbourne Food and Wine Festival in the city that David now calls home.
No.
Oh, no? No, you still live in?
No. You asked whether I turned it into a business or not, and I suspect that I have. I'm a great believer in self-deprecation. I think it's the best approach.
Keep going.
I started a restaurant called Dali Street Thai after I came back from Thailand. Well, let me continue. I met this woman who cooked that wonderful dish, that pla, geng som pla chon tot, pai makam. That's when I had the first taste of proper Thai food with its poise and elegance, with its depth and character. And I went to her place every day for about 6 months because I was just besotted. I went to her like a babe does to a mother's teat to try and suck that old bitty dry of all of her knowledge because she was an heir to an ancient tradition. She was born in a palace. Oh, no, she wasn't born in a palace. She went to school, or she was finished in a palace. And all girls of good standing, of good family in old Siam, because she was born when Thailand was called Siam, were finished in palaces. And there were so many palaces. But what they were was bastions of culture, of Siamese culture, where women, who were the mainstay of Thai culture, were taught the important things, and food was paramount. And she was taught how to cook and how to finish dishes, and you could see in the elegant way in which she cooked, or rather the results in which she which left her kitchen, you could feel there were generations of cooks that had taught her and honed her craft, and it was outstanding. My head nodded up and down like a happy little puppy each and every time I had a dish of hers. And I still have the original book that I wrote from the notes. And this is now almost coming up to 30 years. So impressed was I by her. I'd hate to say it was a culinary epiphany because I think that's rather pretentious, but it was certainly a moment of a turning point in my life. And it made me realize that Thai food was more than just the food that I thought it was. And so I spent all the remainder of the 2 years that I was living in Thailand just tasting and eating and getting fatter and enjoying the country, but also doing as much research, and I say research with a certain sense of irony, because it was eating and it was drinking and having a good time. And then I went back to Australia in 1992-93. And opened a restaurant called Dali Street Thai. It was like a Siamese cat falling on my feet. Some publican offered me a restaurant in the back of their hotel in an insalubrious suburb called St. Peter's, which was a bloodbath of a bloody hotel, and I took it. We started cooking Western food, and to satisfy me and my cravings, we did occasional Thai nights. And then all of a sudden it became so successful, we switched over. And I found myself cooking more and more Thai food, happily. I have to say, but with a certain naivete. I had a very limited knowledge. I thought I had a reasonable knowledge, and I suppose in comparison to most Westerners at that time, I had a substantial knowledge, but I look back and think, I scoff with embarrassment and shuffle my feet, thinking, oh, really? But Darley Street Thai was the first place, and then that moved to King's Cross with its pink walls, its azure ceilings, and it was a glittering jewel box, like indeed a Siamese temple or a Thai temple, full of colours, full of taste, full of memories, full of aromas, full of chaos, and it was a fun time. Was it a business? I don't think so. Restaurants back then were far easier to run. They were less regimented, there was less pressure on margins, there was less commercial reality impinging upon the day-to-day operation. Of course, they had to be run like a business, but they were a little bit plumper, the margins were a little bit plumper and a little bit more generous, and so you could afford to take more risks. It wasn't as expensive to set up a restaurant, labour wasn't that expensive, and food was not, the cost of food was not that expensive, and so therefore it was easier to run. It's much harder now.
Also, morph into the next step after that, which is the audacity of moving Nam to Thailand as a fine dining restaurant and the transition into Long Chim and the place that we are now.
Darley Street Thai continued on until 2001. And then a woman called Christina Ong gave me a call, who's a great hotelier, and she had a restaurant in London, or a hotel in London called the Halkin. And she asked me whether I'd be keen to go over to London. And it was at the time that Blair was in power, and it was cool Britannia, and it was exciting, it was thrilling to go over there. You see, I went back to Australia in 1992, at the time where Sydney was in the headlights of the culinary world. It was an exciting, thrilling place. It was Australia was seen to be very interesting indeed. And then I moved over to London in 2001, at the very time that Cool Britannia and the idea that you could eat in London well started to form. Having spent some time in London before then, I knew that you had to, normally had to eat before you went to Britain. But that changed quite a lot, quite considerably. And so I opened a restaurant in London called Nam at the Halkin Hotel in 2001. It was called Nam because we had all the elements. What have I said? Water is one of the most important elements in Thai culture. And we had all the other elements in the hotel and in the restaurant. We had metal, we had fire, we had gas, we had hot air, and some of which you're listening to now. We had water, we had everything, but we had very little water. And so I thought, in order to get a balance in the whole operation, the name Nam, which means water, ought to be used. And so that was how Nam arose. And Nam was a continuation, a reiteration, a reincarnation, rather, of Darley Street Thai with its palace or regal aspirations. And when I say regal, it means pursuing old-fashioned recipes, most of which came from the court or from those palaces, because they were the only ones that were extant. Nam grew to be better than Darley Street in many ways, not as much fun, but more because restaurants started to become more standardized then and far more structured. But also it became better because we were getting our ingredients flown out of Thailand twice a week, which allowed us the very wherewithal to cook. In Australia, we used to have farmers and growers to brew things for us, but nonetheless, they were limited somewhat, whereas there was a huge repertoire or a variety of ingredients that became available, and that allowed for an immense expansion in the repertoire of what we could cook, and allowed a lot more of the recipes that I had recorded and collected to be put into play because we had the ingredients there. That went from 2001 to 2010. We'll need to check on that. I can remember the days, but the years are a bit of a blur. 2010 or 2011, perhaps. And it closed because there was changes in the EU regulation that meant that about 90% of the ingredients that we were flying in became unavailable. for a variety of reasons, it just decimated our business. Well, it did more than decimate, actually. And so I just realized it was no longer fun. We had guys scurrying around like rats, pursuing each Asian provider to find ingredients in order for us to construct a menu. But it wasn't a wonderful idea of going to the market and going to Asian shops in order to pick the best, in order then to, with a luxury, decide what the menu could be of the best ingredients, the most succulent and fresh and zesty of produce available. It was austere and poverty-stricken, and it was just irksome because they there was nothing available. All of London was suffering from the lack of Thai ingredients, or at least in Thai restaurants anyway. And so I remember the day that I decided it was no longer viable. I just opened up Naam in Bangkok, again with a partner, Christina Ong, and there was a cornucopia of ingredients spilling across the table there, but in austere, cold Britain. I still remember two apple eggplants that the poor boys seized upon as if they were rare gems and brought them back proudly to say, look what we found. And I remember thinking to myself, 2 years ago, or 1 year ago, we would have thrown them out as being substandard. And I just thought, this is not the way to run a restaurant. It's not what I want to do. And decided to wriggle out of my contract to just concentrate in Bangkok. On Bangkok, rather. And so Bangkok became a focus. And as Bangkok has grown, and it has indeed grown, it began with a rocky start, for the very reasons that you suggested earlier on. The Thais are a very proud people. And it was, we opened Naam in Bangkok during a time of civil strife. And there was a lot of anger in the community, there was a lot of problems in the community, but none of it could be expressed. And then I did a small interview with a very reputable reporter from the New York Times, from the Grey Lady, but it was done over several bottles of wine. And so I remember me saying, trying to say that I'm, you know, coming back and I want to show that Thais can cook the food that they like to eat and they can sell it rather than being just purveying conventional type of food. But that came across as something very different, and so it splashed across the New York headlines that I came back to Thailand to teach the Thais how to cook. And during that time when Thai sensibilities were raw and tender, great umbrage was taken, and there was a national outcry. I thought I was going to be tarred and feathered. There was national editorials in the Bangkok Post and the Nation about whether Westerners could, first of all, could cook, and certainly had the right to cook Thai food. It was an interesting time. It was a rite of passage. But luckily I'm Australian and I'm illiterate, so therefore I didn't read any of these articles and that much, because it would have been too distressful and too dispiriting, too disenchanting, and I think alienating as well, and would cause me to probably have fled. Not that there would have been danger, but just simply, you know, when you're not welcome, sometimes you ought to go. Donald Trump, are you listening?
We'll close that chapter, listeners. By the time this airs, we'll know what the world thinks of Naam in Bangkok for another year, when we find out what the number is.
Oh, and Donald Trump too. We'll
find out about Donald Trump as well. But that's a story for another day. But if people want the best of David's Thai food, Naam in Bangkok is the place to go. But we're in Melbourne. We'll be in Sydney. You're doing something different in those two places.
I am indeed. I'm a bit of a historian. So consequently, I like researching into old recipes. And that's the province of Naam, with its venerable cuisine, with its arcane ingredients, with its cooks that cook so very well. But that's only one aspect of Thai food. And that's an aspect of Thai food that I loved very much indeed, and still indeed love. But there's another part, a more vivacious part of Thai cooking, a more hip, a more current type of Thai cooking, and that's the food of the streets, and indeed that's the food that most Thais eat. They don't dwell in those Siamese arcades of the past where cooks consider, crafted their meals and cooked their meals with exquisite execution. They eat on the streets where it's fast and rude and robust and delicious and smoky and spicy and fun. And you know, living in Thailand, we never cook at home. I'm like most other Thais, where we just eat on the streets, and it's the best thing. And Long Chim, which is a range of little restaurants that I have at the moment that I've been focusing on, is just exactly that. It's food of the streets and markets of Bangkok. Yes, there's some nice recipes, and I have the same degree, the same adherence to proper technique and faithfulness in taste as I have at Nam, but the recipes themselves are much simpler and much, much more faster and far more immediate and less complicated, thank God. And so Long Chim is just street food, and you'll see me doing pad thais, or you'll see other guys doing satays, things that I would have disdained as being too popular and too commonplace, and certainly aren't seen in Nam itself. But they're happily seen here because they're eaten on the streets, and so whatever is done on the streets of Bangkok, well, almost whatever is done on the streets of Bangkok, is done in Long Chim.
We're sitting here today in Melbourne, in the casino complex. So that's where Long Chim is in Melbourne. Was Long Chim in Sydney before that or after that? And where is that?
Long Chim means to come and sample and come and taste, and it's with that happy invitation we opened up some restaurants. First of all in Singapore 2 years ago, then in Perth a year ago almost. Oh gosh. And then in Sydney 8 months ago, and now in Melbourne 2 months ago. It's been a rapid expansion. It's just street food cooked with some faithfulness and some degree of honesty.
And tomorrow you're going to help us decide what we should eat, I hope. And perhaps you even prepare some of it yourself. That would be a wonderful thing for us to do, and then we can tell the world whether we really like it or not.
I'd be delighted for you to come, but it does depend on whom you voted for in the last election.
Who do you think?
Oh dear.
That's pretty close to an insult, David. the people in my house were 100%, and in the opposite direction. So
then I can offer you the world.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us so thoughtfully. We wish you continued success with Long Chim. We wish you continued success with Nam in Bangkok. We'll be rooting for you to get a good number on Wednesday night, and I hope our paths will cross again, because it's been so much fun to have someone reflect so charmingly about what it is they've been able to achieve. You're an understated person, I know, and I'm glad for that, but I think you should take a good deal more credit for what you've achieved.
I squirm with embarrassment.
I squirm
with embarrassment. I come from an older generation where I just feel uncomfortable about talking about myself or talking about any successes that I might have had. So allow me that. However, I will be delighted to cook for you tomorrow night at Long Chim.
Thank you so much.
No, I didn't expect David Thompson to be so cerebral either, but it was indeed a very interesting conversation, and he's certainly a fascinating fellow. And now it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. And I find that I'm constantly expanding my horizons when I experience these different cuisines around the world. And this was no exception when we ate at Victor Leong's restaurant and talked to him about his Malay China Australian fusion. We are at a restaurant called Li Ho Fook, and I'm going to ask the chef owner to tell you why, what that name means. And the chef is Victor, he says, Leong. I would say Leong. Of course, I'm Chinese, right? Anyhow, I'm looking forward to talking to you, and I'm looking forward to your food, which is a wholly new style to me. Let's start with, where are we? Because you recently moved.
So we're at Li Ho Fook in Melbourne. It's located on 11 to 15 Duckwood Place. It's just off one of the iconic laneways of Melbourne, Flinders Lane, between Exhibition and Russell Street. And we're housed in a wall store that was built in 1920s. This whole area used to be in the fabric and rag trade around here, so a lot of garment makers, fabric makers. So this used to store the wool to service the other kind of small industries around here.
This restaurant talks about the red neon sign. Why is that?
The red neon sign, I really like the idea of a laneway that had a red glow, kind of like in Asia, like you would find in, you know, Singapore or in Hong Kong. And when I designed the bar downstairs, you notice that there's a red or pink kind of neon glow from the inside out. So I love the idea that when you're upstairs, you'll see the red neon sign that's outside the front of the restaurant glow a warm red into the restaurants, and then downstairs, if you're up top of the street, you'll see the building glow red from the inside out.
Now, your background is Chinese, Malaysian, born where?
So I was born in the mid-80s in Brunei. My parents were born in Malaysia. My grandparents were born in China. And we immigrated here when I was very young, when I was 6 years old. So I did all of my schooling, my university and my culinary training in Australia.
How do you understand Chinese food then, or Chinese Malaysian food? You learned it from somebody.
I think I grew up eating a lot of Chinese food. You know, my parents, my mother mainly was a very, very good cook, and a lot of the kind of nostalgic flavors from family dinners and kind of birthdays and events when I was growing up have always been centered around Chinese food. And once I kind of finished, you know, all of my culinary training and went and worked in a lot of, you know, French kitchens and European kitchens, I kind of turned the corner going, hey, you know, I really want to open my own restaurant. What kind of cuisine should I commit to? And I always felt that Chinese food was always really fascinating, and I was more passionate about that than, say, putting, you know, 20 kilos of mash through a tammy. I always thought that'd be interesting kind of exploring my culture. So it was more kind of like an exploration of an identity that I've kind of forgotten for a while. So
towards the end of our stay here in Melbourne, which has been, you know, very, very enjoyable and very interesting, but there's this old-fashioned part of Melbourne's food culture, which is Chinese, going back a long time. Victor, how did that come about?
You know, Melbourne's, you know, famous for having a very rich history of immigration outside of Sydney, because I think there was a big kind of gold discovery around this area. So, you know, it naturally drew in a lot of migrant workers. A lot of Chinese people worked the gold fields. You know, a lot of Italian and Greek migrants came in to kind of tend the land and grow the wines, and that's why it's like a large and long history of immigration and settlement around here. And, you know, and the place had a lot of gold, you know. In the early 1900s, Melbourne was one of the richest cities in the world, and you can tell from the architecture, from, you know, how wide the laneway, the boulevards are, and that's why each kind of main street has a lane, because lanes are a service lane. And yeah, with that, you know, Melbourne's got one of the oldest and largest Chinatowns in the world. So, you know, the kind of historical links to Chinese culture and community in Melbourne.
And we're down one of those very laneways. I discovered that you can actually get out the other end, although by the time you get out the other end, the name of the street has changed two times. So the red neon sign is very helpful for people to find it. But somebody else got in this laneway in a sort of a decorative fashion, and that's true all across much of Chinatown as a whole. Where did all this graffiti stuff start?
Well, you know, Melbourne's got a very liberal, culturally free attitude to stuff. I think the general, because I'm originally from Sydney, so moving to Melbourne to open this restaurant, I've actually noticed that people, go to sporting events more, go to exhibitions and art festivals more. There's always a festival on Melbourne in terms of, you know, film, food, like the comedy festival's on right now, the food festival's on right now, you know what I mean? There's always a very interesting and eclectic mix of people that come through here, you know? You think about the sporting events that Melbourne hosts, you know, we host the tennis, we host the Formula One, we host the MotoGP, and the people that travel to follow that, they bring a whole kind of layer of interesting interests as well. So I think the fact that you can have street art down the laneways quite legally, you don't get a fine in a lot of these laneways for decorating the street art, is kind of one of the charms of Melbourne. You know, you can go up the high streets and see architecture from, you know, the 1850s, and then go down the laneway and see, you know, an original Banksy around the corner. You know, and I think there's one right there. And it's cool because then it's, you know, it always feels like there's activity. You know, there's and different layers of activity. So not only are you traveling for, you know, a destination, you're also traveling for art, culture, or even just, you know, the urban streetscape type exploration. It's, you know, makes Melbourne a very vibrant city.
It's a very different attitude. Back home, a friend of ours' son was street artist or graffiti artist, and he ends up in jail. They actually jail people. It's really amazing. But you're really from Sydney, and you had an interesting, couldn't we call it a culinary apprenticeship in a sorts? Tell us a little bit about your experience with Chef Fest.
So when I finished university, I went straight into a chef's apprenticeship. So I worked for Mark Best for a number of years, and at the time I was really lucky. I got in probably at just before he peaked. So, you know, the year I joined, he got Chef of the Year. The year after, we got Restaurant of the Year, and then, you know, the accolades just kept coming. So you know, Mark wasn't a very big restaurant. It only had 5 chefs in there. So to be 1 out of 5, you got to learn intensively and very closely with the people that work there. And, you know, if you have a look at a lot of young chefs, kind of my generation, they've all kind of worked at Mark because of how intense and how close you work with people of such talent that work in there. It actually makes it feel like, you know, you're entering some kind of like higher education, you know, Dead Poets Society type little club. Like it's awesome because you look at the chefs that, you know, that Mark Best has kind of mentored. You know, there's Dan Hong, Dan Puskas, Dan Pepperell, you know, Brent Savage, myself, Jowett. You know, the list goes on, and it's amazing to be part of that. You know, and I think that it's nice to know that we've all kind of closely worked together and been through this kitchen that was so kind of, you know, it was just like a champion racehorse breeder, this guy.
Now, I've read all kinds of descriptions and definitions of your food. I read it was fusion, and I read it was elegant new Chinese and all this. You had a really good explanation of what it was when we were talking earlier.
So, yeah, I like to kind of call the food that we do here a new style of Chinese food. I think, you know, everyone has got a flavor bearing of what Chinese food should taste and resemble. And for me, it's just putting an Australian perspective on it. So I think, you know, it's a good representation of what is my kind of culinary history and training. Kind of amalgamated into a product which falls under the umbrella of Chinese food. So a lot of the cuisine might not look like Chinese food, but will taste or have refer to a lot of classics in kind of flavor profiles. Then a lot of classic dishes that we reinterpret here will just basically go for a more accurate cooking or just a better flavor balance. You know, I believe that just because it's authentic doesn't mean it's good. You know, there's a lot of dishes that are authentic that are just really out of balance because, you know, it's peasant cuisine, you know. I just have the benefit of 10 years in the kitchen, and I think that, hey, you know, authenticity is a cop-out. And, you know, if you can apply a better technique and have it so that it's more kind of accessible to people, I think that's probably a better approach than trying to just blog it as authentic.
And he's smart, listeners. you give good explanations here. Can you use examples from this menu to sort of amplify what you've been talking about in terms of your food? Can you pick some samples and tell us about how it fits your flavor profiles and how you've modernized traditional flavors?
Yeah, so off the current menu, which is the early autumn menu, we have two signatures that I'll talk about. This we do a spicy beef tartare with the flavors of Mapo tofu. So, you know, being French trained, I really love eating steak tartare. I think it's one of kind of life's pleasures. But on the other hand, in Chinese cuisine, they would never imagine eating raw meat.
Right.
So, you know, so how do we transfer something that I really like in cuisine to something that'll make sense on a Chinese restaurant menu? So we go for a flavor profile that everyone kind of is familiar with. So there's a Sichuan classic called Mapo Tofu, which is mince that's braised with tofu and a lot of chili powder, dried chilies, chili oil, and Sichuan peppercorns. So what we do with the beef is we use a Wagyu tri-tip, which is a rump cut, so it's got a better mouthfeel in terms of like a chew instead of just a fillet. We sear it really hot, like in a really hot wok before we dice it up, so it gets a flavor of it being cooked, but the texture is completely raw. And then we make a spice mix of dried chilies, small kind of aromatic ones, and then large, really fragrant Sichuan-style ones. We toast them up. Blend it into a powder with fermented black beans, which is classically in Mapo Tofu, but we kind of temper the saltiness of the black beans down with cocoa nibs. So you think that's weird, right? But then cocoa is a bean, right? So is fermented soybean. And to make the cocoa, they ferment it. So if you dry both of them and blend them up, and you smell the result, they smell exactly the same. And beef and cocoa is a classic combination in the new European repertoire. So if you think chili and cocoa is also very popular in the Mexican cuisine. So if I'm ticking two boxes in kind of an umbrella that works with one protein, then adding spice that's kind of in the Chinese-esque version. And then you think about like seasoning with soy sauce and black vinegar, which is like a softer savory note and also not a very high acid because the black vinegar is made of malt and rice. So that'll tie it all up. And you think, okay, cool. Now how am I going to sub the pickles in for a tartare? So there's pickled mustard greens, very classic Chinese pickle that tastes exactly like cornichons, and a smoked daikon to kind of amplify the smoked characteristic of when you sear the beef. Mix that all together, and then we have a whipped tofu. So it's just organic tofu that we whip with a little bit of ginger oil. So that's your tofu in the Mapo Tofu. But what's also good is it also mimics that really rich kind of neutral quality of an egg yolk, which is a classic accompaniment in a tartare. So add it all together, you go, hey, this tastes...
It's kind of complicated.
Yeah, well, when you put it all together, it kind of tastes... It tastes like a Mapo Tofu, but with the texture of tartare. So it kind of takes the best of the both. And it works. Because then, you know, you can get a raw, a light entree onto a Chinese menu and also be new style and also create something that is completely original, but people still recognize in terms of flavor and presentation, because everyone who loves French cuisine understands what a tartare is. Everyone who loves Chinese cuisine understands what a mapo tofu is. So the taste and flavor will have reference points from both cuisines. So that's kind of the more new style Chinese that we do. And there's another dish that's been here since we first opened, is the steamed Konbei barramundi, ginger and spring onion sauce, which is really, really simple. Barramundi is a fish that's from Australia. We get a sustainable and local producer from far north Western Australia for consistent sizing and just best practice in terms of production of fish. The traditional Cantonese method is to steam it with ginger and dress it with the soy sauce, kind of showcasing, you know, how amazing the fish is. Problem is, if you just season with just soy is really kind of salty. Depending on the soy you use, can be really dirty in terms of flavor when you're trying to keep the whole dish clean. So we just make a dressing. So we balance out soy with a little bit of white soy, which is a Japanese product, which is very similar to soy sauce, but without the age. So you get a bright salinity as opposed to an aged soy salinity, especially in Chinese soy, where there isn't grades of soy. It's really kind of hard to adjust the saltiness of the soy sauce. And then we kind of fortify the umami flavors with a kombu extract, and then add a little bit of acidity with the rice. With a rice vinegar, and just balance it out with a little bit of water and sugar, and I think it's better than the original, because it just hits all the kind of seasoning and flavor points a little bit more accurately than just dousing something with soy sauce. And then we just garnish it with ginger and spring onions, just like they do in the south of China, except that we use the greens of the spring onions to make a lovely green oil. For aroma, and also just to so it looks cool. And also, it's a wastage thing, because we do go through a lot of spring onions in the restaurants, and, you know, there was a lot of, what do we do with the tops instead of wasting it? You know, there's nothing in my book that's worse than waste. I think, you know, each person in this world, I think, creates enough waste. It's nice to utilize it and also add it to something to give it value and a little bit of character. So, yeah, they're the two dishes that we do here.
I'm glad that you mentioned waste. I mean, that's really one of the hottest topics going in the culinary field right now. And some really outstanding chefs are working to eliminate it. I mean, we had Dan Barber at the thing. Massimo Vettura has gone to great lengths to do that. He actually ran that Expo Milano pavilion, where he took wastes from all the other restaurant pavilions and food services and invited top chefs to make wonderful, fabulous meals out of it. So I'm glad you're backing that, too. We need every little bit of help we can get. It sounds so fabulous to me, what you're doing, and you've thought through all of these things. How do you get your kitchen staff lined up? You're very cerebral, aren't you?
I think, you know, I've always kind of enjoyed cooking as an intellectual pursuit as well as a physical kind of pursuit. You know, it's like anything, you know, you just have to translate it again and again until it filters down into it to be kind of easily moving parts. Otherwise, it just feels like it's a little bit over-engineered. I think the way I look at food is kind of also the way I look at design and, you know, architecture and things. And you go, hey, you know, the longevity of things are usually the simplest, you know, and even the most kind of extravagant and most futuristic ideas and designs have a very relatable sense of either aesthetic or function or a relationship that you have with the item. So, you know, in terms of, I think of all these dishes and then I just pair it back. It's that you know, it's that Chanel quote. It's, you know, before you leave the house, take one thing off. So it's basically like, if I think if it doesn't need to be on the plate, it doesn't, you know, it's not on the plate. So if it does make it onto the plate, it's very focused. And, you know, if you have more than, you know, five courses and you have three or four components on the plate, you know, at the end of the meal, you're having 20 to 24 individually different flavor, taste, textures. So I think that's enough, you know. Yeah, I'd go for a simpler approach in the cooking, but a complicated thought process. Does that make sense?
Yes. Yeah, I wrote a review of one restaurant that kept adding ingredients, and the headline was, "Lock his larder." Peter just wrote me a note. Everybody's been telling us to make sure we have this eggplant dish. Tell me what this eggplant dish is.
So the eggplant, I thought of this dish. I wanted to do something that was a vegan and vegetarian and also an entree and also something that I'd be happy with in 10 years. So I thought about this dish a lot. And I came up with this dish, so there's eggplants, right? And I love eggplants. You know, my mom used to cook a lot when I was a kid. So I went, how am I going to do something that everybody kind of has a bearing to? And it's usually it's a love or hate thing with eggplants, you know, because of its texture and how common it is and how cheap it is. I'm sure a lot of people have eaten a lot of it when they were kids or, you know, in certain parts of their lives or, you know. So I thought, okay, cool. There's a dish called a fish fragrant eggplant, which is a Szechuan classic. My mom used to make it a lot, and it's one of a fish fragrant eggplant. So it's a vegetarian dish. It's got the words fish in it, but it's basically it's the same aromatics you use to cook fish in, but applied to eggplant. It's basically a showcase of how versatile eggplant is with different seasonings and flavorings. So I took the flavor profile of that, which is, you know, chili bean paste, coriander, and Szechuan peppercorns, and in a kind of sweet sour sauce, and I made that into a caramel. So basically like a gastrique in French cuisine. And with a little addition of glucose, because I thought, how does Korean fried chicken, the sauce, keep the batter crispy? And I researched that for a bit, and it's an addition of glucose, it kind of drops the water content in it. So, and then I just had a really good egg batter recipe, which is a rice flour and tapioca starch base. It's got a little bit of xanthan gum in it. So xanthan is a fermented cornstarch, and it's also an emulsifier. If you add it to a batter, it keeps it in suspension, which means that if you ever make a batter with a starch, like cornstarch or rice flour or tapioca starch, if you mix it with water, it's heavier than water and sinks to the bottom. Right, but with the xanthan gum in it, it thickens the water enough so that the starch is in suspension, so you don't need to keep mixing it. It just stays in one homogeneous batter. So, yeah, it's probably about 4 years of hard work, and you know, overnight successes are, you know, take 4 years of hard work, right?
What do you drink with your dishes?
I don't really have a kind of rule. You know, you just drink what you like. You know, I remember when I was a kid, my grandfather used to drink a lot of cognac with his dinner, you know. Yeah, and my dad likes red wine, so he drinks red wine. So, you know, I kind of have manufactured the wine program here for you to have whatever you want, whenever you want it. You know, there's no rules, really. Like, if you want beer, if you drink beer and you like beer, drink beer. You know, if you want to do champagne, that's an amazing, you know, choice. But yeah, I think it all works well. You know, I also try to design the food to make it wine friendly in, you know, in some terms. I don't cook as spicy as I used to. I'm just trying to make it so that nothing, it all kind of comes together as a complete package, which I think is what a good restaurant is, I suppose.
Well, I'm really losing it. I'm so hungry from the smells in this kitchen, or in the bar. We're in the bar now. The smells are heavenly.
Yeah, it's good. You know, I think I've always liked this kind of cuisine because you've always thought that, hey, you know, what is that cooking? Or there's always something that's a little, like, piques your interest. Because I remember when I was cooking a lot of French food, it just kind of all smelled like cooking school. And that's, you know, no one ever wants to go into an environment at work and be reminded of school. I think that's a very depressing prospect. So, you know, it's nice to have that change.
Yeah, I love, strangely, the smell of rice cooking.
Yeah, I think 5 o'clock anywhere in Asia, in my, yeah, every day of my childhood, 5 o'clock, you'd smell that, you know, jasmine rice cooking. It's nostalgic, I think, for me.
Well, it's not nostalgic for me. It's just, except that I know it's going to be good, I suppose so. Victor, thank you for talking to us, and I'm really looking forward to sampling your food. So, any other thoughts you want to add before we close this interview?
Oh, you know, I think anyone who has a chance to visit Melbourne or Australia should, because, you know, I think there's a lot of interesting things, and it's vibrant and it's fun, and, you know, there's probably something for everyone. And especially after hosting some of the world's best chefs in the last couple of weeks, you know, a lot of the comments were, this place has got something almost magical about it. And, you know, I just feel very lucky to be a part of the hospitality and food scene here. So hope to see you in Melbourne.
And did you get to interact with a lot of the visiting chefs?
I did, yeah. I was very lucky to host Momofuku Ko for a dinner here. And just with, you know, so much activity around, it was basically like having the Olympic Games of, you know, cuisine in town. Like, you'd walk down the street and you'd be like, hey, that's Eric Repair, you know. And then you'd see, you know, the guys from 11 Madison Park, you know, Grant from Alinea was around. You know, you'd see, and you'd be like, geez, they're all here. Like, and to know that, you know, going into a bar or, you know, walking into a restaurant, there'd be a chance that you'd see them, or they'd come into this restaurant. You know, we hosted a big list of guys that came through in the past week, and it was just almost dream-like, surreal in how cool that is, you know, and how lucky we are to kind of be able to do that, A, in my restaurant, and B, in the city.
Well, the chefs were greatly impressed with Australia, Melbourne, and you guys. Thank you again.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
A quick apology for the audio sound quality in that last interview. Next week as well, we're going to be playing some culinary masters, but they were people who were in a large room with a fair amount of background noise. So bear in mind, the sound editor apologizes, but I think that the quality here is sufficient to get the story of Gagan Anand, who, for reasons which you'll explain, which I never understood before, he decided that his future lay in opening an Indian restaurant in Bangkok, Thailand.
Start this one.
I'm not serious.
Are you going to open a restaurant in India?
I wash my hands now. I really, because it's completely a disconnect to India, to what I do. Simple, because it's when I was planning to do India, I was almost there, but then I realized that do I do in India just to make money, or do I need to do something which becomes one of the best restaurants from India? So there were two different things.
Right.
If I had to do from India, in India, the cost of economy and the people and the demand and the perception are two very, very complicated situation. So I realized in a very simple way that we need to do three turns of the restaurant. The first turn will only pay the rent. The second turn of the restaurant, the second seating, will only get the cost. And the third seating might give you profit.
Huh?
And I, as a restauranter, cannot do a restaurant with three seatings. So I don't meet India's demand and perception. And I don't get to get my happiness. So it was a disconnect. So I had pulled it out, and the last page of the contract, I just pulled it off. I said, I can't do that. Because I don't think you want to make money. The problem in India is they like to make money on successful people. And I was not there to make money.
No.
That is my thing. I'm already making enough money in Thailand. I'm happy in what I'm doing. I've got what I want. So I can't do that. So
what will your next restaurant be?
I think I have become my soy dog. Soy dog means my street dog. So I'm a lion of my street. No, it's like Indian proverb, no? In India we say that even the dog becomes a lion in his own street. Yeah. So I am my soy dog, in the meaning that I've understood Bangkok in 10 years, what it is, what they like, what is the cost you need to sell. Like Suring is successful because it is under a $70 menu. Yeah. And wow. Full fine dining. And Gagan is a $120 menu. Yeah, and that's the thing. So we understand Bangkok as economically, we understand what is Thai-ness, and then in Thailand, sometimes when you do things which are not legal or not how it is, but then you need to do it in that way to make sure that you survive the business and become a part of Thailand.
For example,
like I don't allow wines from outside. The only restaurant, apart from Roboshan, don't allow wine from outside. That's illegal in a way that is antisocial.
From outside, what? I mean, like,
because in Thailand, people even yeah,
you can't even bring in anything, man.
They can even bring their wine glasses.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Welcome to Thailand.
Yeah.
They bring their wine glasses, but I educated the society. I made them understand, and then I was not trying to be, but what I tried to do was to get very good wines, which were not the famous labels, but sell them at the price, and import my own wines, and give a customer a wine which they have never heard about, or just heard about, and yet in a very affordable price. Because in Thailand, it's very important. Is value for money is very important. Huh? You can't take a Thai for a ride. Yeah, that's very important.
So, you're going to shut down Gagan?
Yes.
Go roving, apparently?
I'll become a hippie.
I can see it from the shirt.
Yes.
Renee is busy doing pop-ups around the world as well. So, it seems to be becoming a bit of a trend for top chefs. Why do you think that is?
I can't be compared to Renee or others, but I don't want to also, because every chef has his own inspiration and admiration. I want to be a monk, okay, but I can't be a monk. I have a wife and a daughter, but I want to be a food monk. And what is food monk? Is to quit fame, is to quit success, is to quit everything that comes with success and go back to cooking.
Okay. Like a kind of cooking nirvana.
Yeah, cooking nirvana. I want to go back to my Zen. That's why I'm going to Japan. Because I can't survive that in Thailand. That's what I'm saying. In Thailand, if I do a 12-seater restaurant with what I have, with the fame I have, and the issues that I have, I'll have a problem. Because when people will not get it, so they will be very angry, they'll be pissed at me, I'll be barred from the society. There's so many things. But I can only manage, and I want people to be booked in advance. So only thing that I can do that in Asia, and the country where I really love to go and I really belong there, is Japan. That's why I chose Japan. Still there are issues in Thailand that everything comes out of a water and not soil. Happy Bonics.
Why is that?
Young money.
But it's not necessary. It's such a luxury.
No, it's the supermarket culture. That people want to eat strawberries all throughout the year.
But I mean, globally that's changing, isn't it?
No, I'm a drummer, so I like to
do that. You're drumming into my record.
Globally, that whole conversation is changing, isn't it? More and more people are sort of becoming conscious of the importance of provenance of food. Are you saying Thailand's behind times?
No, is that that Westernism that has come? That People talk about sustainability of life and things.
Well,
every year I'm launching a new chef.
So you've done Suring.
I've done Suring. I've done meat dishes at a steakhouse. No, beef burger, no, beef steak. It's a steakhouse kind of thing. Easy comfort food. It's only for Thais. Yeah, and some expats who live there. It's comfort food. And then it's the third restaurant I've opened, the fourth restaurant actually. One is mine restaurant. And fourth is Ga. As not Ga, as G-A-A-S. G-A-A is Garima Arora. She's a female chef. Okay. She's a, what we name is an eclectic cuisine. Now, what is eclectic cuisine?
Everything.
Correct. Thank you. So,
sorry,
it's everything. Yeah, she doesn't have a cuisine. She's got everything in it, so I call it eclectic.
Which segues nicely to something that I really would love to pick your brains on. What is Indian cuisine? It's something I have a personal bugbear with, as you well know. There are so many...
What are the bugs you have?
There's so many different regional cuisines in India. So when people say, oh, Indian food, I mean, obviously your food's different from China. But, you know, the perception is...
You're from the same city that I come from, right?
Yes.
You're from Calcutta.
You don't think only food. Everything's dal makhani.
Yeah. The thing is... And that's...
How do you kind of... translate that into
a restaurant? See, the problem comes back to us. The poverty and the struggle that we went through after the independence. We took Indian restaurants as methods of immigration. Yes. So we fought, not only us, but all our neighboring countries. Bangladeshis, Pakistanis, we went to. They have given hope to chefs like us. That we can cook better and we can get that fame. So these chefs have given us the path. Today, when I will exit Gagan, I will make path for 200 other young chefs in India who will follow this fame and will have motivation to it. So they gave us motivation. And they're still giving us motivation. So we in India have a joke that if you want to eat better Indian food, go to London. Yeah. But that's the thing. But nobody knows that none of those cuisines are doing Bengali. Which is the most refined Indian cuisine in the world.
So underrated.
And we only cook fish. I want to talk about it. There are two ways to look into it. Yesterday, I met a guy who I heroed all my life. I met him for the first time. Heston Blumenthal.
Oh, he's wonderful.
Yes. I heroed him. I bought his book, Fat Duck. Okay. I bought the Fat Duck at home, Perfection. I was reading how he perfected chicken tikka masala. Right?
Yeah.
And I met him. And he said something to me yesterday, which made my life. He said, Gagan, I know you. I know you do this, you do this. I love you. He was following me. I felt on the top. I felt on my top of my career. A person you heroed all your life and he made you feel on top. That's a hero. Not someone who discredits. He comes and takes it.
Listen, that's all for this week. We promise more exciting stories from the Melbourne Food and Wine Festival and the World's 50 Best Restaurants next week. So don't be a stranger. And until then,
bye bye.